I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, for more than 1,500 years, scholars and believers have pored over the 63 volumes of the Talmud, the central text of Jewish law and thought, without an index. That is, until now. We speak with the author of the Talmud Index in just a few minutes. But first, it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. Today, though, we turn to a difficult topic, the end of life. Who should decide when life should end? In this country, by law, custom, and faith tradition, that decision has traditionally been attributed to a higher power, except under rare circumstances. But a small but persistent group of activists have argued for years that people should have the right to make that decision for themselves, especially in cases of persistent and debilitating illness. Now, many people know the name of Dr. Jack Kevorkian, the late physician who died in June, who was a famous and outspoken activist in behalf of assisted suicide. Less well known, but equally significant in this movement, is our next guest, Dr. Lawrence Egbert. Dr. Egbert is a retired anesthesiologist. He's also the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. That's a group that's helped people suffering from terminal illness and their lives. In that role, he estimates that he has approved applications for 300 people seeking to end their lives. He says he's been present for 100 suicides in the past 15 years. He was profiled in the most recent Washington Post magazine. The story is titled "The End Is Near," and Dr. Egbert joins us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, there was an online chat after the article was published last Sunday, and you responded to a question by saying, "I don't assist in a suicide. I help people stop their suffering." How do you make that distinction?
I think it depends on what you mean by suicide. I don't use the word suicide either. I think that suicide has a lot of religious connotations. It's a very sad thing to have happen, whereas a number of the people who are hastening their death are stopping their suffering and are looking at it with great anticipation and pleasure.
How do you decide whom to assist, or in your role as the medical director for Final Exit Network, how did you decide? I want to get to that, but I want to decide what was the criterion for deciding whom you would assist and whom you would not.
We start with the decision starts with the patient who says, "I want this." So it's a request. We never ask people to do it. We don't put any pressure on them to do it. A person asks us to do it, and we then start with the assumption that it's a reasonable thing, and then we ask them why. And we ask them why in great detail. We have a first responder who has a whole questionnaire. We then interview them. We then require all their medical information from their doctors to send us copies of their medical history. So then we if that all seems to make sense, we then assign a guide. And the guide can do this all over again in person. In other words, actually meets the person applying.
Now, the article mentions that you once served as a Unitarian Universalist minister, and I'd like to ask how your faith informs your work. And I also hope you tell us as briefly as you can, because I understand it's a very complicated story, because it's a complicated issue, how you decided that this work was work you were willing to do.
Well, that's two questions.
It is.
First question of being a Unitarian minister at Johns Hopkins University, basically I was a lay minister who was responsible for Johns Hopkins students who were Unitarian Universalists. And that was interesting and good. And sometimes when we had complicated issues, we would bring up and invite other people in with the possibility of students to meeting them. But most of these students were not interested.
Well, no, my question was, how does your faith tradition inform your decision to assist in helping people to end their lives? That was my question. Because as we discussed, I mean, for most of the faith traditions with which people will be familiar, obviously some take a different view. That is, should be acknowledged. From the religions that most people practice in this country, it's just simply wrong. And so I'm interested in how your faith tradition informs your decision to help people end their lives.
Well, Unitarian Universalists basically believe in autonomy. They believe the individual has a right to be responsible to themselves. Collectively, in General Assembly in 1988, the Unitarian Universalists voted to approve the idea of physician assistance in hastening death.
Now, I think it's worth mentioning at this point that you've paid a price for your advocacy and your work in this area. You've been arrested more than once. You were tried in one state, and those charges were dismissed or you were acquitted, but there's still a case pending against you. And that when you were arrested, you had been an assistant visiting professor at Johns Hopkins, and you lost that position because of the arrest. And so I'm just interested in the fact that you're willing to continue to face these issues, to advocate for this work and to do this work. And I wondered why that is.
Well, the patients need this work. Dr. Kevorkian could tell you that. The patients are very appreciative of this, and so are a lot of other people who have had relatives who have not had this care. I hear story after story after story of people who have said have a relative who couldn't get this, who didn't get proper pain care, and although the pain care was so much that they were unconscious. So that I think that the idea of the patients saying they really want this. If you have yourself, you get a horrible disease and you're suffering all the time and the doctors are doing a wonderful job, but it just doesn't seem to work. That's what 1% or 2% of the population. So 98% are taken care of very nicely. But what we're interested in is that occasional 1% or 2% who are not. In Oregon, for example, where this is legal, in Oregon, less than 1% of the people actually use the service. Less than 1% of those who die.
We're speaking with Dr. Lawrence Egbert. He's the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. That's a group it's a membership organization, actually, that helps people end their lives, especially when they are experiencing persistent and debilitating illness. He was profiled in the latest issue of the Washington Post magazine. And you mentioned Dr. Kevorkian. The article compares you to him, but you have some differences of opinion with his approach. Can you tell us what they were?
He's a little more flagrant than I am. I tend to be quiet, and he tended to be noisy. He also is a musician and considerably better musician than I am. What he would do, for example, he would help a patient very similarly to us. The patient would apply, ask him, and talked with him, and he would then sometimes say, I don't want to do this, which we do also. So he, in other words, I don't want to be part of this, which he did. But I had a good contact with a Unitarian minister in Ann Arbor who had a parishioner do Kevorkian, work with Kevorkian, and he found him incredibly careful and thorough. I would like to think the same for us.
Well, you know, obviously we don't have the time to resolve all the profound, you know, philosophical issues that this whole question raises. But I did want to ask you, this week, we're ending a week that began with the March for Life. That's an annual event to protest the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. And this raises, in this country, and it raises, you know, similar questions. And so I just like to ask in the just a minute and a half that we have left is, do you envision a time when we won't be arguing over these issues, when this country will have sort of settled itself on this question, kind of one way or the other?
I think there will always be people who are fundamentalists in a religious point of view will be opposed. However, I think there's very real progress. More and more people are saying this is a reasonable thing. For example, right now, Massachusetts and Vermont are working on this very hard to pass a law to say they would be like Oregon.
And you feel, let's say if you and I were to get together 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, what is your prognosis? You think that this assisted suicide will be legal in more places than it is now?
I think hastening death will be more legal, yes.
Because?
Because I think people want it. People want to say that I'm me and I don't want to suffer more than I can handle. Sometimes I can handle the suffering and sometimes I can't.
Do you ever think that you might be wrong?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah, sure. I know also I think about something like referring to the Nazis, the slippery slope, and this might progress to something where people will be asked to. You talk to there's a group called Not Dead Yet, who they will tell you this very clearly, that they're worried that we'll expand this so much that we'll try and remove them. Personally, I think that loses the basic idea. That is the idea of choice.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Egbert. Dr. Lawrence Egbert is a retired anesthesiologist. He's also the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. He was profiled in this week's Washington Post magazine. The piece is titled The End is Near, and he came to speak with us in Washington, D.C. Dr. Egbert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, a step-back view of the week in politics, and much of the recent talk is focused on wealth, who has it, and how do they get it. Fairness was a theme of President Obama's State of the Union address.
We can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by.
Or he said we can have an economy where everyone has a fair shot and everyone plays by the same rules. Last night, in the GOP presidential debate, Mitt Romney went after Newt Gingrich for his million-dollar-plus consulting contract with Freddie Mac.
We discovered, to our shock, Governor Romney owns shares of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Governor Romney made $1 million off of selling some of that. Governor Romney owns share and has an investment in Goldman Sachs, which is today foreclosing on Floridians.
That actually was Newt Gingrich's response to Mitt Romney, and the former Massachusetts governor countered that just as his blind trust included mutual funds that held Freddie Mac bonds, Newt Gingrich's did too. We thought of inviting two forensic accountants to duke it out this week, and I think you'll be relieved to know that instead E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution and David Brooks of the New York Times are here, as they are most Fridays. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Good to be with you.
Good to see you, David. E.J. joins us from California. First, the State of the Union. It's an election year. The House and the president are at loggerheads. David Brooks, what did the president set out to do, and how well did he do it?
He set out to be popular. You know, I think he had some big themes, the fairness and everything. What disappointed me about the State of the Union was the size of the proposals he had. We have some big problems, a huge debt problem, a huge wage stagnation problem, a huge distrust in government problem. But there was no big Simpson-Bowles plan. There was no tax reform. There was no sweeping out of all the special interest deals in Washington. And then there were a lot of little tax credits. There were some good things like getting community colleges to work closer with labor markets. But it was a bunch of medium-sized proposals, which may be marginally good or marginally bad, but not up to the challenge we face.
Well-phrased, though? Well-delivered?
Yeah, I thought well-phrased, well-delivered. I think the equality, he pulled back a little from some of the economic populism, which to me doesn't sell. But, they were a series of popular policies that will appeal to independents. I just don't think they're big enough for the moment.
EJ, your thoughts on the State of the Union?
Well, if populism doesn't sell, David has to talk not only to Barack Obama, but also to Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich. It sounds like we're all populists now. I mean, President Obama tried a big deal on the deficit, and it didn't work. The Republicans weren't going to work with him. And he has been on the upswing since September, when he stopped pretending he could get the Republicans to do things in common with him, and instead started making an argument, the way Ronald Reagan used to make arguments and Bill Clinton used to make arguments. Obama's argument is about reducing inequality, increasing upward mobility, and he's in favor of a careful but clear role for government in doing both of those. And I think the combination of a somewhat better economy and the Republican gutter fight between Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney and this speech might get the president so happy that he'll sing an Al Green song again at a fundraiser.
Well, let me ask you about the Republican gutter fight, I believe was EJ's phrase. David, is there anything actually, setting Ron Paul aside, who's quite different from the three other candidates, is there anything apart from attacks on how people made their money and what they said 10 years ago? Is there anything actually different about the three leading Republican
candidates? No, what's remarkable about the Republican Party now is how incredibly unified it is. There's a basic agreement. You have to do a tax reform. You have to simplify the tax code, lower the rates, and get rid of the deductions. There's a basic idea that you have to reform entitlements, either by introducing market mechanisms, by means testing it, so affluent people get fewer benefits. On the big proposals, no matter who gets the nomination, on the big things, Republicans are more unified than ever since I've been covering politics, I think.
The question is who's being most authentic about it, more so than what do they stand
for. Right. But though I think you could say even if they're faking it, the entire Republican Party is in favor of those things, so that president will do those things. And the question is how committed. And what to me the big thing that happened this week is Mitt Romney decided he was in a knife fight and he was going to pull out a knife. And that's what really impressed a lot of professional politicians, a lot of people in the Romney campaign. He decided, I'm not going to lose to that guy. I'm going to be as savage as I need to be. And God knows he was.
EJ, I want to ask you about something that Newt Gingrich says often. As Democrats delight in the Republican fratricide and delight in the possibility of a Gingrich candidacy, it seems, he keeps on saying, hey, Ronald Reagan was 30 points back a year before the 1980 election. I'm now back too, but I'll do what he did. Does he possibly have a point?
Well, I think every Democrat and liberal ought to be careful and remember that. But I think that a lot of people doubt that Newt Gingrich is Ronald Reagan. And so, but be careful what you wish for. Just on what David said, I think he is very charitable to the Republicans. Most of them really want to slash the revenue going to the federal government. And so it will be very hard to have the kind of careful balance that David rightly talks about all the time. I am struck with how whatever they are actually for is being lost in all these attacks. And I think it's a real problem in Florida. Florida is a state the Republicans really want to win. And to have all these terrible ads up on the air just can't help them for the fall. Maybe it'll go away, but it's not very good for them now.
David, you spoke of political professionals. Those are people who sometimes are intended when people speak of an establishment. I've heard many references to the Republican establishment about that supposedly supports Mitt Romney. Is there a Republican Party establishment?
No. Right now, the establishment, the definition is that somebody who actually knows something about Newt Gingrich. And those people really don't like him. And so they served with him. They worked for him. Look at what he did this week. He's in the most important political week of his life. He gives a speech about whether we should have statehood on the moon. This is not a guy
after the colony has been established.
This is not a guy with a firm grip on how to be a disciplined leader. And we saw it this week. And it's weird in the debate. He couldn't attack Mitt Romney because it's hard for him to stop talking about himself. And so he's just not a great candidate. So that's the establishment, people who know about him.
EJ, is the concept of a party establishment still germane?
Maybe it will be on Newt's moon. I mean, I think that David's right, that the establishment right now are all the people who've worked with Newt Gingrich. And I am also struck by his lack of discipline. I mean, he came on really strong, did, you know, a heck of a job in South Carolina. And now he can't stop talking about Saul Alinsky, a name that probably means more to people on the left who like him than people on the right who've never heard of him. And this moon idea might work a little bit. I mean, after all, the space program is headquartered in Florida. But it's a lack of discipline that strikes you once again about Newt.
On that note, E.J. Dionne, David Brooks, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we want to turn to another story that touches on profound matters of faith and spirituality. Today we take a look at the Talmud. That's the book of Jewish tradition, thought, practice, and values, and it lies at the center of Jewish study. Every day, thousands of Jews pore over the text, reading and rereading. It's more than 5,000 pages. And until now, only people with an extraordinary memory or a lifetime of dedication could easily find their way through its 63 maze-like volumes. But after 1,500 years, students can now use what is believed to be the first comprehensive index for the Talmud. And with us now is its author, Daniel Redder. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Daniel, what's it called in Hebrew?
It's called the Hamafteach, which means the key.
The key. And how did you come up with the idea?
Well, as you know, I'm an attorney. And as an attorney, I use legal books every day to do my research. And I've been learning, I've been studying the Talmud for 50 years. I've been teaching the Talmud for about 25 years on a daily basis. And I wondered why it was that when I needed to find a precedent decision, when I needed to find a interpretation of a particular statute, I could easily access this information through the index, which would be found in the back of the law book. And yet the Talmud, which is the basis and foundation of all Jewish law, basically refers to the Bible, the five books of Moses, and its many, many thousands and thousands of discussions. There was no what I thought was a practical or actually an index at all. And in order for me to be able to find what I was looking for, I'd either have to ask someone who was much smarter than I was, or I'd have to search my own memory or basically do without.
Well, it's... Yes, one can easily see why this was a good idea. How hard was it to come up with a framework for this? I would imagine that after 1,500 years and nobody's done it, it would be rather difficult.
Well, it was a 7-year labor of love. The methodology involved was the idea of being able to find entries or topics. And once we had the entries or the topics, we would build on them and have sub-entries and subtopics. And once we had all of those, then we would develop the sources or find the sources. So almost seven years ago, I decided that this is what was needed. And my wife, Margie, who's a lawyer in her own right, said to me, Danny, 1 minute, you know, we're very traditional. The Talmud studies, very traditional. The rabbis are very traditional. And I'm not so sure that you want to do something as revolutionary as this without getting the haskamot or the approbations or the endorsements of the various rabbis throughout Israel, throughout America, throughout the world. And if you work on this for many, many years and you finish it, and then it's not accepted for whatever reason, then you've really worked for nothing. So taking her good advice, I worked for about 2 years, and we developed a template where we covered all of the various tractates, the 63 tractates. And then I basically went around the world, went to Israel rather, went to America. And unlike the normal author who writes a book and then seeks endorsements, here was a situation where I just sketched out the basic idea, the basic plan with many, many examples. And then I went to the various rabbis, both rabbis, the Sephardic rabbis, the Ashkenazic rabbis, the Hasidic rabbis, the Lithuanian scholars. And they not only were very much encouraging, but they said, Mr. Redder or Daniil, do it quickly because this is needed. So once we had that, so to speak, green light, we spoke to many rabbis, many students, and we asked them for suggested entries. Of course, we did not tell them what it was about. We just wanted to develop entries. I had my own database of entries. And then I was fortunate. I found a wonderful rabbi in Israel named Rabbi Elchanan Cohen of Bnei Brak, who helped me and was my senior editor. And together we put together about 6,500 entries. Once we had the main entries, we then developed sub-entries of about another 27,000. So we had a total of about 35,000 topics that were found or that are found in all of the Talmud, or we call it Shas. And then we were able to develop the sources where these topics are found. And now after 7 years, thank God, we finished.
It truly was a labor of love. And I do want to mention that the first printing sold out in a matter of days. So one has to assume that there will be subsequent printings. But before we let you go, Mr. Redder, thank you so much for speaking with us about this, which clearly was such a labor of love. You know, there have been scholars in the past who said that studying the Torah should not be too easy. And so I do wonder if there's anybody who said, no, you're just making it too easy. Part of the study is the mystery of it and the unraveling and the dedication. What do you say to that?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that because my Rabbi Willig, where we live in New York, wrote in his approbation or his haskama to my book, to my Sefer, he said, you know, there are people who think that looking for a source and wasting time doing that is part of learning Torah. And he cited the famous Rabbi Huttner, the former Rosh Yeshiva, the former head rabbi of Yeshiva Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn, who said, no, that is not part of learning. That's not part of working for the Torah. It's no mitzvah to spend time, to waste time looking for something if it can be found more handily. So to answer your question directly, I do not think that there is any purpose or reward in looking for something if it can be found more easier.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you again for having me.
Daniil Redder is the author of the, say it again for me, the Hamaftek. The hum of tech?
Close. Hamafteach. The key.
The key. It is believed to be the first comprehensive index of the Talmud. He is also a lawyer, and he joined us from our member station WLRN in Miami, Florida. Thank you so much for joining us, and Shabbat Shalom.
Michelle, thank you. Thank you very much.
President Obama also used his State of the Union message to advance his interest that more kids actually get to college. He called on states to require students to stay in school until they graduate or until they turn 18.
When students don't walk away from their education, more of them walk the stage to get their diploma.
The White House cited studies that show that raising the compulsory schooling age helps prevent kids from leaving school. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports on how much of this is true and how much of it may be wishful thinking.
For Paul Leather, New Hampshire's Deputy Commissioner of Education, President Obama's call is the right call.
Well, what it does is it sets the moral imperative so that students and parents and educators become committed to the idea that each student will, in fact, graduate.
New Hampshire recently became one of only 21 states that require kids to stay in school till 18. Leather says it did so after looking at the research.
What we found, both in national and international research, is that when you raise the compulsory age of education, the graduation and retention rates will, in fact, increase.
So, yes, there's evidence kids might stay in school a little longer. But do these laws actually lower the dropout rate? Not really, says Russell Rumberger, professor of education at UC Santa Barbara and author of the book Dropping Out. Requiring kids to stay in school until they're 18 sounds like good policy, says Rumberger, but it doesn't have the impact people think.
You can't just look at the graduation rates or dropout rates by a state and relate it to its compulsory schooling age and saying, aha, there's a direct connection.
Rumberger says all you have to do is look at the 21 states where the compulsory schooling age is already 18. In Nevada, the dropout rate is 58%. Louisiana, 43%. California, 37%. The figures in the other 18 states aren't much better. And then there are states like Kentucky, where kids can leave school as early as 16. That's been the law since 1934. And yet, Kentucky has in recent years dramatically lowered its dropout rate by focusing on the causes. Lisa Gross is with the Kentucky Department of Education.
The reason kids drop out in Kentucky, and I suspect that this is the case nationwide, is not because they're falling behind. It's because they don't see a connection between what they're learning in high school and what their lives are going to be like as adults.
Gross says Kentucky has worked really hard to provide students multiple pathways to graduation. It has created a support system and gotten parents involved. Although, holding on to some kids is not cheap or easy, says Gross.
If you force children to stay in school when they don't want to be there, schools spend a lot of time addressing discipline problems and other issues that pop up.
Still, Gross says President Obama's remarks were important. Russell Rumberger agrees. As long as people don't come away with the expectation that raising the compulsory age to 18 is going to solve the nation's dropout crisis.
I don't want to discount it. It's an important thing to do in the right direction, but by itself, it's probably not going to make a big improvement.
Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
I was reminded today of these lines from the poet William Carlos Williams. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. I was thinking about that because we're starting an experiment on the program to find poetry in the news. Each month, we'll be bringing in a poet to spend the day with us at All Things Considered, and at the end, to compose a poem reflecting on the day's news. And to start our series off, we've invited Tracy K. Smith to be what we're calling our news poet. Her latest book of poems is titled Life on Mars. And all day, Tracy's been here following us around, thinking about today's news and shaping that into verse. Tracy, welcome. It's been great having you here. How did it go?
Oh, it's been delightful and a little terrifying also.
I was thinking this is sort of an unfair task. To have you do a poem on command in such a limited amount of time, and specifically to sort of be following on the headlines. Is that a weird position to be in for you?
Well, only the time constraint, I think. I often find that news events are things I'm thinking about and wrestling with and trying to understand better. So generally, I find myself taking time and trying to maybe inform myself a little bit more about stories that have struck me in one way or another. And writing a poem is one of the first approaches that I take to trying to understand something a little bit better.
Huh. When it came to actually sitting down and starting to write, how did you have the germ of an idea? What was the trigger for you?
I find that it's easiest to get into a poem if I can find a particular subjective point of view. And so one of the stories in today's news about Nigerian Southerners leaving the North in an attempt to kind of escape violence really struck a chord because of the women's voices that were quoted in the story. And so the sense of individual lives and even just individual bodies gave me a starting point.
Great. Well, Tracy K. Smith, let's listen to the poem that you came up with today.
New Road Station. History is in a hurry. It moves like a woman corralling her children onto a crowded bus. History spits, go, 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 lurching at the horizon, hammering the driver's headrest with her fist. Nothing else moves. The flies settle in place, watching with their million eyes, never bored. The crows strike their bargain with the breeze. They cluck and caw at the women in their frenzy, the ones who suck their teeth, whose skirts are bathed in mud. But history is not a woman, and it is not the crowd forming in a square. It is not the bright swarm of voices chanting no and now, or even the rapt silence of a room where a film of history is right now being screened. Perhaps history is the bus that will only wait so long before cranking its engine and barreling down the road. Maybe it is the voice coming in through the radio like a long-distance call, or the child in the crook of his mother's arm who believes history must sleep inside a tomb or the belly of a bomb.
That's the poem New Road Station, written today here at All Things Considered by Tracy K. Smith. Tracy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And stay tuned. Once a month, we plan to invite a poet into our process, and we'll bring you their lyrical impression of the day's news.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Imagine walking into Jamba Juice for your favorite smoothie fix, and when it's time to pay, instead of pulling out cash or a credit card, you just tap your phone on a reader, and you're ready to go. Better yet, when you tapped your phone to pay it, it also redeems an electronic coupon stored in your phone, so you end up paying even less. Yeah, well, people, in fact, can already do this at Jamba Juice using Google Wallet. On certain Android phones, you can use it at Macy's, Bloomingdale's, Duane Reade. We're not doing a commercial here. We're just telling you that it's spreading. The list is going on. And AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, they've all teamed up to launch their own version of something called the Mobile Wallet. It's going to be finding its place everywhere later this year. But how safe is my banking information stored in my mobile wallet? And what's going on in it and what's in it for me besides the coupons? Here to talk about it is Giles Eubanks. He is lead analyst for cards and payments at Data Monitor in London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira. Thanks for having me.
How ubiquitous is this now?
It's still very, very early days. It's still quite in its nascent phase of development. What you're seeing at the moment now is, you know, it's been years in the making. This is something people have been talking about, this sort of technology, for at least 10, 15 years now. But it's only now that it's really starting to finally hit the market. But even then, it's not quite the big bang that many people are hoping. It's slowly creeping out. Where these things are actually rolling out now, it tends to be focused much more on big urban centers.
Right.
And even there, you know, the U.S. is much more advanced than quite a few other countries are, at least compared to Europe. You need to look a bit further afield to countries like Japan and South Korea, see really what that kind of environment really exists like once it's been in place for a few years.
And what is the benefit for me as a consumer in doing this?
Well, this is, you know, that's a big question. That's a, you know, very strong one, which I'm not 100%, you know, sure that anyone has actually answered that quite yet. It's, you know, it's the key thing that, you know, everyone will keep saying in the industry is it all boils down to convenience. You know, there's this weird notion within the sector that people love their mobile phones, and they have to make payments. So that way they'll love using their mobile phones to make payments. I don't think the connection is necessarily that one-to-one. Now, where it does become more interesting is exactly what, you know, Google's doing. It's, I think very much the big attraction is when you can add in that extra functionality, right? Because, you know, these handsets, these cell phones, which everyone has, they're becoming increasingly powerful. It's not just about making the payments anymore. It's when you can suddenly start tying that into, you know, your location, you know, any kind of loyalty programs you may have. It could even be, you know, identification, kind of access control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it all starts tying together. It all starts becoming very personalized.
Yeah. If you take this to the next step, why do you even need the checkout counter at all? Why can't you just take your can of peas, put your cell phone on it, it takes a picture of the barcode, and you pay for it right there? You walk out of the store.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Apple has actually released something like this quite recently. They have an Apple App Store app, you know, for the iPhone, which you can download. They've started trialing in a few cities. It's serviceware. It doesn't use the actual NFC contactless chip, but what you can do is you can actually go into the store, take a photo, you scan the barcode, and you can pay for it right then and there, you know, using your iTunes account, and that's it. You walk out. You get your receipt emailed to you. I don't actually know how the security works on that. I don't know how they stop, you know, kind of shoplifters from just walking off with everything under the sun. But I do know, you know, they'll have certain parameters in there to stop people from, you know, walking off with laptops. And if you need, you know, someone from the shop to actually help you with those. But, you know, if you just wanted to buy a pair of headphones, you can do that. That actually exists today.
Is all that information on our phone safe? I mean, and safe for us, for we consumers?
Actually, surprisingly, is quite safe. It's The real focus for the contactless mobile side of things, something called the NFC chip, that stands for Near Field Communications. Now, what that chip does, it sits separate. It's its own little chip within the handset, which it's very, very secure. That's why it becomes suitable to use for things like payments. But it extends quite, you know, a bit further than that. I've just read today there's the big airport technology software provider, SITA, has been trialing a proof of concept for NFC mobile contactless ticketing, you know, that includes check-in, boarding, and even lounge access.
I guess here's a tweet that came in. Somebody wants to know what happens when you lose your phone. And it's got all that information in the phone, your bank account and all that kind of stuff. Is there a security risk there?
Oh, there is. I mean, there always is, right? I mean, if you carry a wallet, that's a security risk as well. You could drop it on the bus. You could fall out anywhere. The big difference is, you know, with the handset, you can switch it off. You know, it's what a lot of handsets can do now. What I would actually recommend to most of your listeners, you know, make sure you do have a PIN that you can actually put on there to actually, you know, to open the whole thing. Yeah, but a really interesting statistic is, you know, the average amount of time it takes someone to realize they've lost their wallet is something like 5 or 6 hours. It takes people about 15 minutes to realize their phone's missing.
Oh, that is better. Yeah. then the panic sets in.
Yeah, exactly.
Panic earlier. So yeah. What is the future? So the mobile wallet, basically we just sit back and wait for it to hit us?
Well, it's I think what you're going to see happening now is you're going to start seeing a lot of products launching over the next few years. But the actual, you know, the market, how it's going to work, that's not settled yet. You know, I think kind of the user actual, you know, experience, how it actually works, you know, how many buttons you need to push to actually switch the thing on, I think it still has a long way to go. It could happen very quickly. I mean, if Apple launches something that's very slick in the next 6 months, you know, I could picture everyone imitating that very quickly. But I think it's going to be more of a slow burn, you know. There's a lot of breathless estimations that, you know, the wallet is going to be obsolete, you know, 10, 15 years from now, no one will be carrying a wallet. But if you look at it this way, you know, people still wear wristwatches. You know, it's not quite ready. I don't know if consumers will ever be ready to just fully abandon, you know, more traditional means.
Yeah, we said that about green cash when the credit cards came in, and there's still a little bit of that lying around.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you, Giles.
Yep, no problem.
Giles Eubanks is lead analyst for cards and payments at Data Monitor in London.